surprisingly full of swells and gentlefolk, along with their small armies of body-servants, fan-wavers, dressers, and bodyguards. Countess Antonia's banner-draped box was empty, but Baroness Ezrintame and her entourage filled the box to its left. Baron Bulidazi's promised friends and associates filled a lengthy arc of the luxury balconies, and had apparently brought more friends and associates of their own. Jasmer walked to the center of the stage and was joined by a man and a woman who came up from the crowd. The woman wore the robes of the Order of Morgante and carried an iron ceremonial staff. The man wore the robes of Carlo Androno and bore a blessed writing quill, the gods responsible for public order and law. These were the divinities publicly invoked before a play in any Therin city. The crowd quickly grew silent under their gaze.
"We thank the gods for their gift of this beautiful afternoon," thundered Jasmer. "The Moncrane Bulidazi Company dedicates this spectacle to Antonia Countess Espara. Long may she live and reign."
Silence held while the priests made their gestures, then returned to the crowd. Moncrane turned and began walking back to the attiring chambers, and the crowd burst once more into babble and shouting. Carlo and Galdo went smoothly onto the stage, sweeping past Moncrane on either side of him. Locke shook with anxiety. Gods above, there were no more second chances.
"Look at these scrawny gilded peacocks!" yelled a groundling, a man whose voice carried almost as well as Jasmer's had.
The penny pit roared with laughter, and Locke banged his head against the grill.
"Hey, look who it is!" shouted Galdo. "Don't you recognize him, brother?" "Faith, how could I not? We were up half the night teaching new tricks to his wife."
"Ah, peacocks!"
roared the heckler over the laughter of the folk around him. He seized the arm of a tall, bearded man beside him and raised it high.
"Ask anyone here! It's no wife I keep at home!"
"Now this explains much!" cried Galdo. "The fellow is so meekly endowed, we mistook him for a woman!"
Locke tensed. In Camor, men were coy about lying with other men, and also likely to throw punches for less. It seemed Esparans were more sanguine in both respects, though, for the heckler and his lover laughed as loud as anyone.
"I heard the strangest rumor," yelled Carlo, "that a play was to be performed this afternoon."
"What? Where?" said Galdo.
"Right where we're standing. A play that features lush young women and beautiful young men." "I don't know, brother. Do you suppose these people have any interest in seeing such a thing?"
The groundlings roared and applauded.
"It's got love and blood and history," shouted Galdo. "It's got comely actors with fine voices. Oh, it's got Jasmer Moncrane, too."
Laughter rippled across the crowd. Sylvanus, peering out his own grill nearby, chortled.
"Come with us now," shouted the twins in unison.
Then they threaded their words together, pausing and resuming by unfathomable signals, trading passages and sentences so that there were two speakers and one speaker at the same time.
"Move 800 years in a single breath. Give us your hearts and fancies to mould like clay, and we shall make you witness to murder. We shall make you attestants to true love. We shall make you privy to the secrets of emperors. You see us wrong, who see with your eyes, and hear nothing true, though straining your ears. What thieves of wonder are these poor senses?"
While they declaimed, bit players in red cloaks marched silently onto the stage, wooden spears held at cross-guard. Two carried out the low bench that would serve as Sylvanus' throne.
"Defy the limitations of our poor pretending," said the twins at last, "and with us jointly devise and receive the tale of Orin, son and inheritor of old Salarius. And if it be true that sorrow is wisdom's seed, learn now why never a wiser man was emperor made."
Carlo and Galdo bowed to the crowd and withdrew with grins on their faces, chased by loud applause. 800 people watching, give or take. Now they expected to see a prince. Locke fought down the cold shudder that had taken root somewhere between his spine and his lungs, and wrapped himself in his red cloak. He was seized by that sharp awareness that only came when he was walking into immediate peril, and imagined that he could feel every creak of the boards beneath his boots, every drop of sweat as it rolled down his skin. Genora placed Locke's crown of bent wire and paste gems over his red headcloth. Sylvanus, Jasma, and Alondo were already in position, watching him. Locke took his place beside Alondo, and together they walked out into the white glare of day and the maw of the crowd. 6. It was almost like fighting practice, brief explosions of sweat and adrenaline followed by moments of recovery and reflection before darting into the fray again. At first, Locke felt the regard of the crowd as a hot prickling in every nerve, something at war with every self-preservation instinct he'd ever developed skulking about Camor. Gradually, he realized that at any given instant, half the audience was as likely to be looking at another actor, or at some detail of the stage, or at their friends, or their beer, as they were to be staring at him. This knowledge wasn't quite the same as a comforting shadow to hide in, but it was enough to let him claw his way back to a state of self-control. "You're doing well enough," said Alondo, slapping him on the back as they gulped lightly wined water between scenes. "I started weak," said Locke. "I feel I've got the thread now." "Well, that's the secret. Finish strong and they'll forgive anything that came before as the mysteries of acting. Mark how Sylvanus seems more deft with every bottle he pours into himself. Let confidence be our wine." "You don't need bracing. Now there you have me wrong, Lucasa. Pretend to ease long enough, and it looks the same as ease. Feels nothing like it, though, let me assure you. My digestion will be tied in knots before I'm 25. At least you're convinced you'll live to 25. Ah, now, what did I just tell you about feigning outward ease? Come, that's Valadon being hauled off to his death. We're on again." So the plot unwound, implacable as clockwork. Orin and Ferin were dispatched on their clandestine errand to infiltrate the thieves of Therim Pell. Orin was struck dumb by his first glimpse of Amadeen, and Ferin confided his premonitions of trouble to the audience, some of whom laughed and shouted drunken advice at him. A bit player in white robe and mask drifted into the shadows of the stage pillars, representing Valadon, first in the chorus of Phantasma. Orin and Ferin set out to win the confidence of the thieves by brazenly robbing Bertrand the crowd, who all but vanished into the role of an elderly noble. Alondo demanded Bert's purse in the over-considerate language of the court, and while the audience tittered, Bert barked, "Who speaks these words like polished stones? Who lays his threats on silk like fragile things? You are drunks, you are gadabout boys playing at banditry. Turn sharp and find your mother's boys, or I'll have you over my knee to make bright cherries of your arses. Heed words or steal, 'tis all the same. You have your choice, but we must have your purse," said Locke, drawing his dagger. Alondo did likewise, playing up Ferin's discomfort. The blades were dull, but polished to a gleam, and the crowd sighed appreciatively. Bert struggled, then recoiled and unfolded a bright red cloth from his arm. "Oh, there's a touch, bastards," growled Bertrand, tossing a purse to the stage and going down on his knees. "There's gentle blood you've spilled." "All by mischance," cried Locke, waving his dagger at Bert's face. "How like you now, these fragile things, old man? Faith, he cares nothing for our conversation, cousin. He finds our remarks too cutting." "I have the purse," said Alondo, glancing around frantically. "We must away, away or be taken." "And taken you shall be," shouted Bert as Locke and Alondo scampered comically back to the attiring chambers. "Taken in chains to a sorrowful place!" The pace of events quickened. Orin and Ferin were enfolded into the confidence of Amadeen's thieves, and Orin began to make his first direct overtures to Amadeen. Penthra, ever suspicious on Amadeen's behalf, followed the two men and learned their true identity when they reported their progress to Callimachus the sorcerer. Locke watched from behind his grill as Sabitha and Chantal quarrelled about the fate of Orin. He admired the force of Chantal's argument that he should be taken hostage or quietly slain. She and Sabitha played sharply and strongly off one another, driving the murmur and horseplay of the crowd down whenever they ruled a scene together. Next came the confrontation between Orin and Amadeen, in which the Emperor's son broke and confessed his feelings. Behind them, Alondo and Chantal leaned like statues against the stage pillars, backs to one another, each staring into the crowd with dour expressions.
"You rule my heart entire. Look down at your hands. See, you hold it already," said Locke on one knee. "Keep it for a treasure, or use it to sheathe a blade. What you require from me, so take. With all my soul I give it freely, even that soul itself."
"You are an emperor's son."
"I am not free to choose so much as the pin upon my cloak," said Locke. "I am dressed and tutored and guarded, and the way to the throne is straight with never a turning. Well, now I turn, Amadeen. I am more free in your realm than in my father's. Thus I defy my father. I defy his sentence upon you. Oh, say that you will have me. Since first I beheld you, you have been my empress waking and dreaming."
Next came the kissing, which Locke threw himself into with a heart pounding so loudly he was sure the audience would mistake it for a drum and expect more music to follow. Sabitha matched him, and in front of 800 strangers they shared the delicious secret that they were not stage-kissing at all. They took much longer than Jasmer's blocking had called for. The audience hooted and roared approval. Another brief rest in the attiring chamber. On stage, Bert, as the old nobleman, wounded arm in a sling, sought audience with the Emperor and complained bitterly of the lawlessness of Therimpel's streets. Sylvanus, regal and red-cheeked, promised to loose more guards into the city. Donker, still hooded and masked and silent, accepted a particular wrapped parcel from Genora and quietly took it into a private office. Jean, lounging at the back door, nodded at Locke to signify that nobody had tampered with the wagon or its cargo. Back out into the light and heat for the irresponsible revels of the thieves, Orin and Amadeen's brief moment of defiant joy, while Penthra and Ferrin brooded separately behind their backs. Now Amadeen grew careless and cocksure, and Ferrin begged Orin uselessly to remember his station and his charge. A terrible end came swiftly to this idyll, in the form of bit-players dragging Chantal out of the attiring room, red cloth clutched to her breast. Penthra had gone out into Therimpel to clear her head with minor thievery, run into the Emperor's troops without warning, and come back mortally wounded. When Chantal spoke her final line, Sabitha wailed. Then, while all the other major players stayed frozen, Chantal rose and donned her eerie, beautiful death mask and her white robe. Penthra's shade joined that of Valadon as an onlooker. Recrimination followed. Amadeen stood aside in sorrow and shock, while Ferrin, in despairing rage, first cajoled and then ordered Orin to slay her.
"Now, Orin, now! She stands bereft of all power! See how her curs crouch in awe! None shall impede you! A moment's work will teach your enemies fear forever! I shall not teach anyone that I destroy beauty when I find it, nor betray love when I profess it," said Locke. "Swallow your counsel and keep it down, Ferrin. I am your prince."
"You are no prince, save you act as one. Our sovereign majesty, your father, has charged you to execute his justice."
"My father watered fields with the blood of armies. I will not water stones with the blood of an unarmed woman. That is execution, yes, but not justice."
"Then stand aside and let it be done in your name."
Alondo drew his long steel, taking care to slide it hard against the scabbard for the most sinister and impressive noise possible.
"Look away, prince! I shall swear to your father it was done by your hand. Twice now, Ferrin, have you presumed upon my patience?"
Locke set a hand on the hilt of his own sword.
"Never shall I stand aside, nor shall you presume again. A third time closes my heart against you and dissolves all friendship."
"Dissolves our intimacy, prince. Such is your right and power. Dissolve my friendship you cannot. I act in this matter as a friend must. So I presume again, though it cuts my very soul, and charge you to remove yourself."
"I loved you, Ferrin, but for love's sake I'll slay you if I must."
Locke drew his sword in a flash.
Advance on Amadeen, and you are my foe.
You are an emperor's heir, and I an emperor's servant, cried Alondo, raising his blade to the level of Locke's.
You can no more run from your throne than you can from the turning of the sun. It is upon you, prince. Your life is duty.
I have no duty, if not to her. Locke snarled and lashed out, catching Alondo's right sleeve, as though Ferrin had not truly expected Orin to strike.
And you no duty, if not to me.
I see now you are soft as the metal of your naming, said Alondo coldly, massaging his wounded arm. But I am the true Ferrin Iron. I shall mourn thee. I mourn thee already, unkind friend, unnatural son. Here's tears for our love and steel for your treachery.
Alondo's voice became an anguished cry as he leapt forward. The racketing beat of blade against blade echoed across the crowd. All the jokes and muttering died in an instant. Locke and Alondo had practiced this dance exhaustively, giving it the motions of two men furious and beyond reason. There was no banter, no clever blade play, just harsh speed, desperate circling, and the brutal clash of metal. The groundlings drank it in with their eyes. Ferrin was the better, stronger fighter, and he pounded Orin mercilessly, drawing blood, driving Locke to his knees. At the most dramatically suitable moment, Ferrin drew back his arm for a killing thrust and received Orin's instead. Alondo took the blade under his left arm, dropped his own sword, and spilled out a red cloth. His collapse to the stage was so sudden and total that even Locke flinched away in surprise. The groundlings applauded. Locke and Sabatha held one another, perfectly still, while Alondo slowly rose and went to the rear of the stage to receive his white mask and robe. The final scenes were upon them. The sun had moved to crown the high western wall of the theatre. Another fray and tumult. Bit players in imperial red advanced their spears upon bit players in the grey and leather of thieves. Calamaxes followed, black robe flowing, red and orange pots of alchemical smoke bursting behind him to mark the use of his sorcery. At last the screams died, Amadeen's subjects were wiped out, the slaughtered thieves and guardsmen rose as one, donned robes and masks, and joined the looming chorus of ghosts. Jasma pulled Locke and Sabatha to their feet, pushed them apart, and stood dividing them.
"The kingdom of shadows is swept away," said Jasma. "His Majesty, tendering your safety, bid me watch from afar and then retrieve you. I see your duty is nearly done, though it cost you a friend."
"It has cost me far more than that," said Locke.
"I shall not go with you, Calamaxes, not now or ever.
Your life is not your own, my prince, but something held in trust for the million souls you must rule. You as heir secure their peace. You slain or lost to dalliance condemns them to mutiny and civil war. You who claim the throne are claimed by it as tightly."
"Amadeen," said Locke.
"She must die, Orin, and you must rule. You will find the strength to raise your sword, or I will slay her with a spell. Either way, my tale shall flatter you to your father's court, and none live to contradict me."
Locke picked up his sword, stared at Sabatha, and cast it back down to the stage.
"You cannot ask me to do this."
"I do not ask, but instruct," said Jasma with a bow. "And if you cannot, then the spell."
"Hold, sorcerer!"
Sabatha brushed past Jasma and took Locke's hands.
"I see the powers that sent you before me conspired as much against your will as my realm. Take heart, my love, for you are my love, and never shall I know another. Let it be a final and fatal honesty between us now. My kingdom is gone, and yours remains to be inherited. Show it much kindness."
"I shall rule without joy," said Locke. "All my joy lives in you, and that but shortly. After comes only duty."
"I shall teach you something of duty, love. Here is duty to myself."
Sabatha pulled a dagger from her sleeve and held it high.
"I am Amadeen, Queen of Shadows, and my fate is my own.
I am no man's to damn or deliver."
She plunged the dagger between her left arm and breast and fell forward gently, giving Locke ample time to catch her and lower her across his knees. Sobbing was easy. Even the sight of Sabitha pretending to stab herself was enough to put rivers behind his eyes, and he wondered if this touch would be admired as acting. He held her tight, rocking and crying, under Jasmer's stern, still countenance. At last Locke released her. Sabitha rose and walked with languorous grace to the waiting line of Phantasma, who received her like courtiers and concealed her in the most elaborate cloak and mask of all. Locke stood and faced Jasmer, composing himself. "When I am crowned," he said, "you shall be turned out of all my father's gifts, your name and issue disinherited. You shall be exiled from Therimpel and from my sight, wherever that sight should fall."
"So be it, my prince."
Jasmer reached forth and lowered a gold chain of office onto Locke's shoulders, followed by his crown.
"So long as you return with me."
"The way to the throne is straight with never a turning," said Locke, "save this which I had to my sorrow. I shall return." The phantasma parted, forming two neat ranks, revealing Sylvanas seated, unmoving, on his throne. Locke walked slowly toward him, between the rows of ghosts, with Jasmer 3 paces behind. Finally, Locke knelt before Sylvanas and lowered his head. 7. Uncanny silence ruled for the span of a few heartbeats. While Locke knelt in submissive tableau, the nearest 2 phantasma swept off their robes and masks to reveal themselves as Carlo and Galdo of the chorus. They strolled to the end of the stage and spoke in unison.
"The Republic of Thieves, a true and tragical history by Caelius Lucarno. Gods rest his soul and let us all part as friends."
The crowd responded with cheers and applause. Sylvanas cracked a smile and beckoned for Locke to stand. Small objects flew through the air, but they were all being thrown against the walls and galleries to either side of the stage. Gods, they'd done it. Only a satisfied audience expended their hoarded vegetables and debris away from the stage. It was the ultimate mark of respect from Therin groundlings. Alondo and Sabitha took off their death masks and moved to stand abreast with Locke. Together they bowed, then made way for Bert and Chantal to do the same. Next came Sylvanas and the bit players. Only Donker remained dressed as a ghost. Moncrane threw back his hood and took the center of the stage.
"My gracious lords and ladies of Espara," he proclaimed, stifling the cheering, "gentlefolk and friends, we, the Moncrane Bulidazi Company, have obtained much benefit from the generosity of our noble patron. In fact, so passionate is my lord Bulidazi's attachment to our venture that he insisted on rendering the most direct assistance possible. It is my great honor to give you my lord and patron, the Baron Bulidazi."
Moncrane had done his part with excellent pretense of enthusiasm. Locke licked his lips and prayed Junkar Kurlin had the nerve to do the same. Donker allowed the phantasma cloak to fall back, revealing an expensive suit of Bulidazi's clothing, requested the previous night in one of Sabitha's forged notes. They fit Donker as though tailored to the hostler's frame. In accordance with Locke's strict instructions, Donker swaggered into Jasmer's place on the stage. Jasmer and the other members of the company bent their heads to him in unison. The bit players were taken by surprise, but rapidly made their obeisance as well, and then the first dozen or so ranks of the crowd. Shouts of disbelief echoed down from the balconies where Bulidazi's friends and associates sat, followed by appreciative laughter and clapping. Donker pointed to them and pumped his fist in the air triumphantly. Then he faced the box of Baroness Ezrintame, extended both arms toward her, and bowed from the waist, all without removing his phantasma mask. Then, just as Locke had directed, he turned and trotted back to the attiring room. As the rest of the company took a final bow together, most of the crowd seemed amused, or at least bemused, by what had just transpired, and then the noisy jostling for the exits began in earnest. Musicians started playing again. The company left the stage, hounded only by a few lingering drunks and those loudly begging kisses, particularly from Chantal, Sabatha, and Alondo. Locke pushed past the bit-players within the attiring chamber and cast off his wire crown. Jean held up a hand and nodded again, and a wave of relief made Locke's knees nearly turn to water. Sabatha saw it too, and clutched Locke's arm. Donker's instructions had been to hurry into the attiring chamber, and, during the brief moments the bit-players remained on stage, take a running leap into the prop wagon and be concealed under a sheet by Jean. Locke knew it was tempting fate to expect Donker to lie quietly in sweltering darkness just above a corpse, but there was nothing else for it. Bulidazi had to vanish like a passing breeze, as Donker couldn't unmask or even utter a single syllable without breaking the fragile illusion. Jean had been fully prepared to bash him on the head if he balked.
"Where has the Baron gone?" said one of the bit-players.
"My lord's friends were waiting to collect him," said Jean. "You can imagine how busy the Baron must be tonight."
"Now for the envoy of ceremonies," whispered Locke to Sabatha. "Quickly, before the waiter annoys her."
"Do you want me to come with you?"
"I think it's our best chance."
He outlined his plan, and she smiled.
"It's no dumber than anything else we've done today."
The attiring chamber was thick with relieved and sweaty bit-players, all collecting robes and masks and props under Janora's demanding direction. There was no time for leisure. The bit-players had to be paid off for their work and sent away without the usual camaraderie and drinking. The company's goods had to be packed and rolling toward the rendezvous with Nerissa Meloria before Meloria herself decamped from the Old Pearl. That was everyone else's business, though. Locke and Sabatha swiftly shed their costume weapons — it was unlawful for them to display such things off stage — and dashed for the courtyard. Out into the sunlight again, past the dregs of the escaping groundlings, through the detritus of fruit peels and spilled beer, they ran up the stairs to the balcony sections and nearly collided with a pair of guards outside the Baroness Ezrintame's box.
"We request an audience with the Lady Ezrintame," said Locke, holding up the signet ring they'd taken from Bulidazi the night before. "We come urgently on behalf of the Baron Bulidazi."
"The lady will not receive players in her private box," said one of the guards. "You must—"
"None of that," came the voice of the envoy of ceremonies. "Admit them, and see that we have privacy."
Locke and Sabatha were allowed onto the balcony, where they found Ezrintame at the rail, looking down at the stage and the drudges, paid for by Moncrane, sweeping the courtyard. The Baroness turned, and the two Camorri bowed more deeply than required.
"Well," said Ezrintame, "your noble patron does come and go rather as he pleases, doesn't he? This is the second time I've expected him and met part of his troop instead."
"My lord Bulidazi sends his most earnest and abject apologies, my lady, that he cannot visit you as required," said Locke. "Leaving the stage just now, he stumbled and injured his ankle very badly. He cannot stand at the moment, let alone climb stairs. He placed his signet in our hands as his messengers, and bid us offer it if you wished to verify—"
"My, my. The Baron Bulidazi is less than careful in his habits. Do put that down, boy. I've no need to bite the Baron's ring. I've seen it before. Is your lord still here? Some of his friends insisted he be taken to a physica immediately, my lady, and without causing a scene," said Sabatha. "My lord was in considerable pain and may not have adequately resisted their blandishments."
"Refusing temptation isn't Lord Bulidazi's particular strength," said Ezrintame, staring at Sabatha more intently than Locke would have liked. "But if he's done himself an injury, I won't begrudge his friends using their brains for once."
"My lord, hopes that you will consent to be his guest at any convenient time following tomorrow's performance," said Locke.
This was a risky ploy if Lady Ezrintame had any reason to find the offer insulting, but if it helped strengthen the impression that Bulidazi was presently alive and planning an active social calendar, it meant everything to their deception.
"I see." Ezrintame steepled her fingers before her chest. "Well, it would be convenient, and the sooner the better. I expect you two will also be in attendance."
"My lady," said Locke, "we would appear if so commanded, but we are only players in my lord Bulidazi's company, and I don't see—"
"Lucasa," said the Baroness, "I should perhaps disabuse you of the notion that I am unaware of Lord Bulidazi's intentions toward your cousin Verena."
I, Locke felt much as he would have if Ezrin Tame had adopted a chausson fighting stance and kicked him in the head.
"You know what we really are,"
said Sabatha in smooth-thrown Therin, saving Locke from another useless sputter.
"Countess Antonia relies on me to be something of a social arbiter as well as her envoy of ceremonies," said Ezrin Tame in the same tongue. "Gennaro is an eligible young peer of Espara who has lost the close guidance of his elders. I prevailed upon several members of his household staff to report on his behavior. Gennaro is, let us say, rather forthright with them concerning his desires."
"Does our presence in Espara cause you difficulty, my lady?" said Locke, trying to force himself to be as collected as Sabatha was.
"You've been reasonably discreet, though I will say that none of you have considered the needs of the larger world around you."
She fixed her gaze on Sabatha.
"I don't necessarily believe it would do any harm to Espara to strengthen its ties with Camor through a marriage, if, of course, that ever was your genuine intention."
"I haven't misled Gennaro," said Sabatha forcefully. "He is overbearing and presumptuous, but in all other respects he is quite acceptable, and we share a significant interest in several arts.
Did your family instruct you to freely choose a future husband during your sojourn in Espara, Verena? I find it very strange if they did. I think you've allowed yourself to forget that you are your family's to dispose of. My sources haven't reported which family that is, but I require this much honesty. Are you a member of a Five Towers clan?"
Sabatha nodded.
"Then you know very well that you serve a duke who may require your marriage elsewhere for political reasons. Even if he doesn't, you will still require Nicovante's permission to wed, much as Gennaro will need Countess Antonia's."
Ezrin Tame rubbed her forehead and sighed.
"Should you ever feel any resentment that I have looked into the affairs of Lord Bulidazi's household, please do remember that I am specifically empowered to avoid thoughtless entanglements like the one you two and Gennaro would have concocted for all of us."
"We didn't mean to leap into it instantly," said Sabatha. "We meant to take several years."
"There, at least, you show a grain of wisdom," said Ezrin Tame. "But patient arrangements are quickly set aside when a woman's stomach swells."
"I can make tea with poor wife's solace the same as any woman," said Sabatha. "I have been thoroughly instructed in avoiding the imposition of a child."
"Rest assured it would be an imposition," said Ezrin Tame. "I will assume that any such occurrence, no matter what sort of accident you plead, is a deliberate attempt to secure a hasty marriage to Lord Bulidazi. I will never threaten your personal safety, but I will certainly threaten your happiness. Is that clear?"
"Absolutely, my lady," said Sabatha.
"Good. Let us speak no more of this until we are under Lord Bulidazi's roof. Now, your company did tolerably well today. A brisk staging despite your winnowed numbers. I'll deliver a favorable report, and I expect that attendance tomorrow will benefit. Dare I assume that Lord Bulidazi has now satisfied his urge to flounce about on stage as a bit player?"
"I fear Gennaro won't be flouncing anywhere for some time," said Sabatha. "His attendance tomorrow will be far more conventional."
"Also good. I suppose you're eager to return to his side."
Sabatha nodded vigorously.
"Then do so. Please express my desire for his swift recovery, and that he might act in a more considered fashion henceforth."
Locke and Sabatha excused themselves, then raced back across the old pearl courtyard toward the attiring chambers. Locke's head swam with the realization of what a fool he'd been to neglect the possibility that the nobles of Espara might have their own sources of intelligence, their own plans and expectations. Baroness Ezrin Tame was more right about one thing than she could know. He had arrogantly neglected the wider world in his scheming.
"I think that was the strangest damn lecture I have ever received," he said to Sabatha.
"You too, huh?"
8. Zadrath's Hyacinth Lane Aquaperia was the most reputable bathhouse in Espara, featuring warm baths, cold baths, steam rooms, and a variety of services both openly advertised and discreetly arranged. Within its courtyard lay a tall central building fronted with decorative columns, surrounded by private outbuildings, one of which had been secured for the use of Lord Bulidazi and his entourage. Welcome clouds were thickening overhead when the Moncrane Bulidazi wagon pulled into the Aquapiria's court, scarcely an hour after the end of the play. Locke, Sabatha, Jasma, Carlo, and Galdo rode, and Donker still lay miserably concealed somewhere in the heart of the wagon's contents. Locke and Galdo, dressed in threadbare but serviceable footman's jackets from the company's property, leapt out, entered the reserved bathhouse, and chased out the blue-trousered, bronze-muscled attendants. "Lord Bulidazi will be here any minute," cried Locke, pushing the last of them out the door. "He desires privacy. He has injured himself and is in a foul mood." When the courtyard was clear, Locke and Galdo helped Donker out of the wagon and into the bathhouse, taking just a few seconds to make the move. Jasma and Sabatha followed. Carlo took the wagon to the stable, there to check the horses and quite literally sit on the corpse of Bulidazi. Each private bathhouse had a theme to its decorations, and the one secured for Bulidazi's use featured toads. Silver and iron toads surmounted all the basin fixtures, and the walls were murals of toads wearing crowns and jewelry while luxuriating in hot baths. A square sunken bath of white and green tiles dominated the middle of the room. It was about 3 yards on a side, and its lavender-scented waters steamed. Beside it, on a low refreshment table, several requested wines and brandies had been set out with a tray of sweets and bottles of aromatic oils. On the left-hand wall, a door led to a large steam room, where water could be poured on a brazier of coals to suit the tastes of those lounging inside. Donker instantly collapsed against a wall, shuddering and gagging. He was frightfully pale. "Easy there, Donker," Locke put a hand on his back. "You've been amazing so far. You've saved everyone." "Don't fucking touch me," Donker growled, gulping deep breaths and obviously straining to avoid throwing up. "You just leave me the hell alone. This is worse than I ever dreamed." "Well, it's not over yet," said Locke. "We still need your clothes." Donker surrendered them clumsily. Locke pulled a dressing screen closer to the door and arranged Bulidazi's wardrobe on and around it, haphazardly. Dagger and jacket he hung from the screen. Silk tunic, boots, vest, and trousers he scattered on the floor. Sabatha threw her own shoes and costume components on the tiles near the bath. She retained only her black hose and a dressing gown. Locke did his best to look like he wasn't staring, and she did an admirable job of pretending she wasn't encouraging him. Once the floor was in sufficient disarray, Sabatha grabbed Donker by the front of his undertunic and steered him to the steam room. "Donker's right," muttered Moncrane as he followed. "This entire plan is thinner than old parchment at too many points." "We're not doing so badly," said Locke. "If we can just get past this, we're safe home with the money in our hands." Donker, Jasma, and Sabatha closed themselves up in the steam chamber. Locke used some of the aromatic oils to slick his hair back and donned a pair of costume optics provided by Genora. He positioned himself next to the door while Galdo ate sweets and examined the wine bottles. There was a knock at the door not 2 minutes later. Instantly, Jasma moaned in a manner that was half pained and half sensual. He'd been retained for this portion of the scheme for one reason. He alone had the depth and flexibility of voice to imitate Baron Bulidazi. Locke opened the front door of the bathhouse. Nerissa Maloria stood there holding a reinforced wooden box, with one of her burly hirelings at her shoulder. The other waited with the carriage that had brought them.
"Oh!" cried Moncrane. "Oh, gods!"
"Mistress Maloria," said Locke, coughing into his hand, "please come in. My Lord Bulidazi instructed us to expect you."
"I said more wine, damn your dry balls," shouted Jasma. "Where is it?"
Galdo busied himself with a wine bottle and a pair of glasses.
"Very interesting," said Maloria, stepping over the threshold and moving carefully to avoid the clothes scattered on the floor.
Her man remained outside and closed the door.
"I'm to present this to the Baron and obtain his mark on a chit."
"The, Baron, my master, tripped and fell after the play," said Locke. "He hurt his ankle quite severely. His, Verena Galante, is comforting him while we wait for a physica."
comforting him, mused Meloria.
Oh, moaned Jasmer, and there was a slapping noise. Now, now, you can keep doing that in a moment. The wine, fetch the damn wine.
The door to the steam room burst open, and grey tendrils slithered out into the air of the main room. Sabitha stood there, gown in hand, topless. She pretended to notice Meloria for the first time, half screamed, and wound the dressing gown around herself in a flash. Then she closed the door to the steam room.
Apologies, she giggled. My Lord Bulidazi is in need of ministration and wine.
She snapped her fingers at Galdo, who passed over a tray with the glasses and open bottle.
Ministration, smirked Meloria. I'm sure that's just what he needs to recover from any infirmity.
Meloria! Is that Meloria?
Locke had to credit Moncrane for his impression of Bulidazi, though perhaps the impresario's resentment colored the act with a touch too much petulance.
Good, good. Sorry I can't receive you at the moment. Just wait a bottle or two. There's a good woman.
Sabitha slipped back into the steam room with the wine. Muffled giggles and laughter followed.
Don't bother with the damn glasses, yelled Moncrane. Just give the bottle here. That's it. I'll put my lips on this, and as for yours...
Locke stood at attention against the wall and tried to look profoundly embarrassed. Galdo hung his head and slunk back to a place on the far wall. Jasmer's appreciative moaning drifted from the steam room for some time. Meloria's dark amusement faded into obvious irritation. Said Locke quietly, I do have my lord's signet ring. Meloria raised an eyebrow at him.
That is, he's entrusted it to me while he's occupied. If you wished to...
Why not? She said. If Lord Bulidazi has no time for me, far be it from me to presume upon his attention.
She set the wooden box down next to the wine and brandy bottles, then unlocked it with a key hung around her neck. She handed a piece of parchment to Locke, who examined it while heating a stick of wax over one of the room's non-alchemical lamps. Locke inked a quill and wrote received at the bottom of the chit. He then gave the document a splash of wax and pressed Bulidazi's signet into it.
I'll need to retrieve the box before tomorrow's performance, she said as they waited for the signet imprint to harden.
Come to Gloriano's rooms any time after sunup, said Locke, and, my lord would wish, that is, were he not distracted.
Locke fumbled two silver coins out of a belt pouch and passed them to her.
Some suitable, gratuity for your trouble.
And for your silence, thought Locke. It was a safe bet that here, as in Camor, the well-off relied on open purses to smooth over their poor behavior. Meloria gratified him by touching the coins to her forehead in salute.
Appreciated, she said. I'll send a man for the box before noon tomorrow.
Locke bolted the door behind her, then ran to the steam room and threw the door open. Moncrane swaggered out, drinking from the bottle of wine, followed by Sabitha in her dressing gown and Donker with a haunted expression on his face. They all gathered at the coin box and peered at the contents. Here and there a silver coin gleamed against the copper.
That's more money than I've ever seen, muttered Donker. Must be pretty heavy. Shit, said Sabitha. Donker's right about that. Where are we going to hide it now that we've got it? We can't have the company members walking around with their pockets jangling. It'll contradict the story that all the money vanished with Bulidazi.
Maybe Mistress Gloriano can hide it, said Donker.
I wouldn't ask her to, said Locke. Her place is going to be full of constables once we report Bulidazi's tragic fire. Some of them might take the place apart out of boredom or thoroughness.
I hope you're not about to suggest that we let you take it out of the city, said Jasmer.
Of course not, said Locke. All we want is enough to let us get home. The rest is yours, if we can find some way to dole it out in portions that won't get anyone hanged.
Moncrane braced himself against the box and stared into its depths for some time. Then he snapped his fingers and grinned. Salvard, he said. Stay awake, Salvard, the good solicitor. He'll hold it at his offices, no questions asked. One of his more discreet services for clients who can't or won't trust a counting house. There'll be a fee, of course, but what do we care? I'll take it myself.
And I'll go with, said Galdo, folding his arms.
Of course, Moncrane's smile nearly reached his ears. "You can carry the box, and someone will need to summon a hired carriage. We can't walk across the city with the damned thing plainly visible."
"I'll take care of that," said Locke, moving to the front door. "Can the rest of you clean up in here?"
"We should leave a bit of a mess," said Sabatha, tossing a wine glass into the steaming bath. "Pour some of these bottles into the floor drain. Whoever cleans up will be able to report that Lord Bulidazi must have had a lot to drink before he went off to have his accident."
"Lovely notion," said Locke, elated. "Right, fix this place up. I'll get a carriage and tell the Aquapiria folk that Bulidazi will be here another hour or so. Let's have Carlo roll off quietly, and we'll all sneak out and meet up on the next block. Then back to Gloriano's for the, last scene of this production."
Not half past the sixth hour of the evening, Carlo, Locke, Sabatha, and Donka clattered in a leisurely fashion through the neighbourhoods of Espara, plainly dressed and with their theatrical property tarped over. Nobody recognized them or gave them any trouble. At Gloriano's, they found the rest of the company safe, but for many rampant cases of nerves. As per the plan, they had chased off all the would-be drinking fellows and raconteurs and parasites with the story that they wanted order and sobriety prior to the Penance Day performance, promising a huge debauch afterward. Locke grinned and immediately huddled in a whispered conference with Jean, Genora, Alondo, Chantal, Sylvanus, and Bert.
"We've done it," Locke said. "Stay awake, Salvard. We'll hold the money. Jasmer and Castellano have gone off to leave it with him. You'll all have to take it slowly, bit by bit, and be sure that Donka gets a full share. He's what you might call fragile." "My cousin'll find his feet soon enough," said Alondo, "and I'll make damn sure he gets his cut."
A general air of relief swept the room. Although Locke wasn't relishing the task of dressing Bulidazi's corpse, and he knew neither of the Gloriano women would appreciate the only obvious location for an all-consuming accidental fire, the worst was past, and the rest could wait for the fall of darkness. Genora's aunt set to work roasting long strips of marinated beef in her wood-fire hearth. Sylvanus made the acquaintance of a bottle of plonk, and the others relaxed with cups of ale. Just after the seventh hour of the evening, Galdo burst into the room, covered in sweat and quite alone. 9.
"I'm sorry,"
Galdo gasped as soon as they'd all moved to the privacy of the room where they'd unveiled Bulidazi's corpse that morning.
"I'm so sorry. He asked me to make sure the carriage was held. He sounded so damned reasonable, like we do, you know? He said that if we had to walk back to the inn, he'd strip my hide. He took the box. About 15 minutes later, I lost patience. I went looking for him, and when I asked Salvard's clerk for Jasmer Moncrane, the man looked at me like I'd been drinking. That's when I figured it out."
"Moncrane's taken the money and buggered us all," whispered Alondo.
"Beggared us all," said Genora. "I can't even... I don't know what to say. It's like all the gods are having a long, hard laugh at our expense."
Sylvanus threw his bottle to the ground and buried his face in his hands. No more eloquent commentary was possible, thought Locke, than that a situation would make Sylvanus Olivius Andrassus waste wine.
"I'm a god's damned fool," said Galdo. "I should have known."
"He's an actor," said Sabatha. "More's the pity, a good one."
"Let's get after him," said Carlo. "He can't be dumb enough to have gone to any of the landward gates, the way they're guarded. He'd be insane to put himself on the roads, knowing an alarm was a few hours behind at best. So where would he go?"
"The docks," said Chantal.
"Well then, let's find him and cut off that damn hand he was scheduled to lose. He's a big old fellow. How hard can it be?"
"We've got no standing here," said Locke. "Remember, we've got no right or call to push anyone around. We are merely actors so long as we're in Espara."
"And you'll never find him," said Genora. "Giacomo's right. Jasmer won't go by land. The docks are thick with Seresti and Ocanti. He'll get out on his choice of ships, and no nightskin will ever breathe a word of it to the constables. The dock workers have no cause to love the Countess' servants."
"So we just let him fuck us," said Bert. "Is that the plan?"
"No," said Sabatha. "There's one thing we can do very easily. We can make it look like Jasmer Moncrane killed Lord Bulidazi."
"I like the sound of that," said Locke. "It'll certainly give the story more weight than Lord Bulidazi getting drunk and setting a stable on fire." "A stable?" cried Janora. "You can't mean—"
"I'm sorry, Janora. I know I should have said something sooner, but it's obvious. We can't burn the inn down, and we can't just have him spontaneously combust in the yard. Don't think of it as losing a stable. Think of it as not letting your aunt hang."
"Castellano, what did you tell the carriage driver after you realized Moncrane was gone?" said Jean.
"I gave him 2 coppins for his trouble and told him I'd decided to stay a while," said Galdo. "I didn't know what to think. I just didn't want to cause a scene."
"Well, you've saved us by keeping your head," said Sabatha. "Here's the new story. After the play, I went with Bulidazi to the bathhouse. Bulidazi received the money from Meloria. She'll testify to that, and she has her sealed chit to prove it. We claim that we don't know what Bulidazi did with the money. All we know is that when he came back here to have a talk with Jasmer, he did not have it with him."
"Simple enough so far," said Chantal.
"Simple is how it stays," said Locke, looking at Sabatha. "If I can presume, I think I know where Verena's going next. We all saw Bulidazi come here. We all saw Moncrane come here. They had a long private conversation, then an argument. They went out to the stables together for some reason."
"A few minutes later, we noticed the stables on fire," said Sabatha. "Bulidazi dead in the wreckage and Moncrane vanished into the night. His guilt will be clear even to a child."
"We'll need to bring Mistress Gloriano in on this," said Jean. "I'm sorry, Janora. I know we meant to keep her out of the lies, but she of all people has to tell the constables that Moncrane and Bulidazi were here tonight."
"There's no helping it, Giovanni. You're right." She put her arm over Jean's shoulder. "Auntie won't be best pleased, but I can get her to do anything we need. Don't worry about her."
"This is still a miserable mess," said Chantal. "Bulidazi's people may yet try to wring every copper they can from us, maybe even fold the company and take its assets. Hell, that's assuming the constables don't just throw us all in the Weeping Tower as assumed accomplices."
"I think," said Locke, "that we might just have a friend in a fairly high place, or, if not a friend, someone with an abiding interest in keeping scandals as subdued as possible."
"There's no subduing the fucking murder of an Asparan lord," said Bert. "Maybe you Camori will get yourselves off the hook, but the rest of us—"
"No," said Locke, "we are absolutely not abandoning you, any of you. Haven't we done enough to convince you of our sincerity? And haven't we pulled off some amazing things together already?"
"Fair enough," grumbled Bert.
"Moncrane fucked us, so we'll all fuck him right back," said Locke. "And for what he's done, let me assure you, he's made an enemy of our master back in Camor. He must know it. He's got enough money to live on for a couple of years, but he'll never be able to stop running. As for the company, I'm sure we can convince our master to lend a hand there as well. He has resources beyond what you'd believe."
"At this point, I'd believe just about anything," muttered Alondo.
"We'll rehearse our story together," said Sabatha, "almost like a play. After sunset, we'll dress Bulidazi one last time and arrange the stable fire. Once it's roaring, members of the company absolutely have to be the ones to go running and fetch the constables. You all have to act surprised and shocked."
"Shock will be easy," said Chantal.
At that moment, there was a knock on the door. Carlo eased it open, revealing Mistress Gloriano wiping greasy hands on her apron.
"Meat's done," she said cheerfully, "and there's good boiled rice and some apricots."
"What? Why are you all staring at me like that?"
"You'd better come in and shut the door, Auntie," said Janora. "Meat's not the only thing we've got to cook before the night's over."
10.
"I don't believe you, Camori," muttered Mistress Gloriano as she helped carry the shrouded corpse of Gennaro Bulidazi from the wagon to her stables just after dark. "Assuming this would be the first time I'd ever helped make a body disappear."
"How the hell were we to know?" grunted Locke.
"I'm in the inn trade in a low part of town, boy. I do like my orderly life, but I've had some folk die in my rooms when it really would have been more convenient for them to be found floating in the bay. So a-swimming they went."
Mistress Gloriano had certainly been upset to learn the truth, but once she'd accepted that Lord Bulidazi had been stabbed by her niece in the middle of an attempted rape, she'd accepted the loss of her stables as a sort of vengeance. Carlo and Galdo had one end of the corpse, Locke and Gloriano the other. They heaved the heavy parcel into a pile of hay, and Gloriano shook a faint alchemical lamp to life. Jean had moved the wagon and horses to the other side of the courtyard, leaving the structure empty.
"Gods, what a smell!" coughed Galdo as they finished unwinding the dead baron. "Reeking meat and alchemical dust!"
"He has looked prettier," said Carlo.
"Damn, he's stiff. This ought to be fun."
The three gentlemen bastards wrestled with the rigor-bound body, fitting it with the jewelry, the boots, and the dagger they'd taken from it the night before.
"Seems a damn shame to waste such a fine blade," said Galdo. "Be an even bigger shame to waste a fine pair of Sansa twins," whispered his brother. "Ugh, his fingers are swelling. I need some help shoving his signet ring where it ought to be."
Feeling like an idiot, Locke assisted as well as anyone could, until the Baron's signet ring was at least plausibly close to the right place.
"Now then, boys," said Mistress Gloriano, "if you're quite finished decorating him, open this oil vase for me and give him a good soak. I dare say I'm quite prepared to light a match on this motherfucker."
A few minutes later, orange flames were roaring against the black Asparan night, and all those members of the company that hadn't run to fetch help were filling water buckets with every outward sign of haste and sincerity. 11.
"This is not how I had envisioned passing the small hours of the night," said Baroness Ezrintame, now dressed in boots, lightweight skirt, dark jacket, and visible sword.
Locke and Sabitha, still soot-grimed from fighting the fire, stood at nervous attention in one of Mistress Gloriano's rooms, appropriated for a private talk. It was after midnight. Constables and soldiers in equal number had the place sewn up tight, and the remnants of the Moncrane Bulidazi Company under guard in the common room. Ezrintame had been summoned by a watch commander when the identity of the charred corpse had become generally known. Sabitha wore what Locke thought was an excellent expression of sorrow and resignation.
Are we so certain it's him?" she said.
"The body was a lump of coal, girl, but we have the signet and the dagger. We know very well it's Gennaro lying out there. I realize it can't be easy for you."
Ezrintame rubbed her eyes.
"Still, it's reality, dead under a sheet."
"Let me help you look for Moncrane," said Locke, who decided that a show of belligerence was a good contrast to Sabitha's shock. "Me and all my men, if I find the bastard—"
"This isn't Camor, and you are incognito," snapped the Baroness. "You've no right to bear arms or dispense justice, and I've no inclination to give you authority I'd have to explain to someone else."
"I'm sorry, my lady," said Locke. "I only meant to offer all possible assistance."
"The best assistance will be to follow my explicit directions," said Ezrintame. "Jasmer Moncrane has murdered an Asparan peer, and he is an Asparan problem to pursue. Gods and saints, this is going to be a 10 years' wonder, even if it doesn't get any worse."
She paced the room several times, staring at them.
"I expect you to leave the city," she said at last. "Yes, I think that would be for the best. I'll secure your safe passage out and have you placed with a caravan. You're welcome to return to Espara as your proper selves after a few years have passed, but never again as players, or any other low station."
"Thank you, my lady," said Locke.
"And what of the Moncrane Bulidazi Company?" said Sabitha.
"What do you expect, Verena? Bulidazi is dead, and Moncrane might as well be. There'll be no more performances, of course. Everything with Moncrane's stink on it will need to be swept under a rug."
"I meant the players," said Sabitha. "They've been most accommodating. That bastard Moncrane has put them in a very difficult position."
"It's the difficult position of Gennaro Bulidazi that will most concern the Countess," said Ezrintame. "But as far as I'm concerned, Moncrane's guilt blazes to the skies. As long as their stories are consistent and my men don't find anything interesting in this rooming house, your associates will live. But the company will be broken up, have no doubt.
Most will end up in chains for debt once the solicitors have finished holding their feet to the fire," said Sabitha.
"What's it to me, my dear?"
"They have given us good service while we've been in Espara," said Locke. "We feel obligated to plead on their behalf."
"I see."
Ezrintame sighed and tapped her fingers against the hilt of her rapier.
"Well, Lord Bulidazi died without heir. No relations beyond Espara that we're bound to respect either.
So the Countess will absorb his estates and his counting-house assets. They're a pretty enough windfall. I suppose my mistress can afford to be generous. The company will absolutely lose its name and its present operating charter, but I believe I can intercede to shield them from anything more drastic. I do hope that will assuage your sense of obligation.
Entirely, my lady, said Sabatha, bowing her head.
Good. You've been foolish and lucky in equal measure, Verena, and I hope you'll remember that you've benefited much from a series of diplomatic courtesies extended on behalf of all Espara.
Within the family, said Locke, we'll be absolutely forthright about your invaluable assistance. Given the chance, we shall remember you to the Duke.
That would be a pleasing gesture, said Ezrin Tame. Now, do clean yourselves up and make ready to leave my city, so I can begin dealing with this damnable collection of headaches.
Chapter 11 The Five-Year Game Returns 1 Dark clouds were rolling in from the north, masking the stars. The Carthenium, palace of the long-deposed dukes and duchesses of Carthane, rose above the manicured gardens and broken walls of the Casta Gravina, a dome of rippling jade elderglass like a jewel in a setting of human stone and mortar. The late autumn wind flowed past crenellations and etchings on the face of the glass, and the eerie music of a lost race sighed into the night, its meaning unguessable. Green and black banners fluttered at the edges of every path and courtyard, and a river of torch and lantern light flowed through the gates of the Carthenium into the Grand Salon, where seemingly endless black iron stairs and walkways spiraled up the underside of the jade dome. Chandeliers the size of carriages blazed, tended by men and women dangling in harness from anchor points on the walkways. The murmur of the crowd was like the wash and rumble of the sea within a coastal cave. Locke and Jean moved warily through the affair, their green ribbons no protection against being jostled by knots of conversationalists, enthusiasts, and drunks. Black Iris and Deep Roots supporters mingled freely and argued freely in a sprawling pageant of Carthane's rich and exalted. In the center of the Grand Salon, a raised platform held a number of slate boards and 19 black iron posts, each topped by an unlit frosted glass lamp. The stairs to the platform were guarded by bluecoats, each sweating under the added weight of a white cloak and mantle trimmed with silver ribbons. It was the ninth hour of the evening. The last ballots had been cast hours before, and now the verified and sealed reports from each district were on their way to the Carthenium.
"Master Lazari! Master Callus!"
Damned superstition Dexa appeared, dragging a muddled platoon of attendants and sycophants in her wake. Her triple-brimmed hat was topped with a replica of one of Carthane's Eldrin bridges, the towers sculpted from hardened leather, each one flying a tiny green flag. Dexa smoked from a double-bowled pipe, puffing streams of grey and emerald smoke from her nose.
"Well, my boys, once we've gnawed all the meat off the bones of an election, it all comes down to this. Count the votes, then count the tears."
"No tears in your district," said Locke. "If I'm wrong, I'll buy a hat like yours and eat it."
"I'd like to see that, but I'd prefer to keep my seat."
Dexa exhaled streamers of jasmine-scented green and spicy grey past Locke.
"Will you gentlemen be near the stage? Ringside seats as the returns come in?"
"Somewhere less hectic," said Locke. "We'll watch from one of the private galleries after we've had a spin around the floor. Got to make sure everyone's got their spine straight and their waistcoat buttoned."
"Very fatherly of you. Well then, until the cat's skinned, my regards to our fellow travellers."
True to Locke's word, he and Jean bounced around the crowd, shaking hands and patting backs, laughing at bad jokes and offering some of their own, spouting reasoned and logical-sounding analysis on demand. Most of it was bullshit fried in glibness with a side of whatever the listener yearned to hear. What does it matter? Thought Locke. One way or another, they were vanishing from Carthane's political scene tonight and would never be held accountable. Vast basins of punch made from pale white and bruise-purple wines were being stirred to foam by clockwork paddle mechanisms, operated by impeccably dressed children walking slowly inside gilded treadwheels.
Attractive attendants of both sexes worked behind velvet ropes to fill goblets and hand them out. Locke and Jean armed themselves with punch, along with steaming buns stuffed with brined pork and dark vinegar sauce. Jean spotted Nikoros hovering miserably on the periphery of a pack of Deep Roots notables and pointed him out to Locke. Vialupa had shaved, which mostly served to highlight his unhealthy pallor and the fresh lines on his visibly leaner face. Unexpected pity stung Locke's heart. Here was no triumphant traitor, but someone thoroughly roasted on the rack of misery. Well, what was the use of being able to lie with impunity if you couldn't use it to take a weight off the shoulders of such a plainly unhappy bastard? "Look, Nikoros," said Locke, pressing his untouched goblet of punch into the Carthani's hand. He spoke softly for Nikoros alone. "I think it's time for me to say that I know what it's like, being pressed by something that rules your conscience against your will."
Master Lazari, I don't... That is, what do you mean?"
"What I'm trying to tell you," said Locke, "is that I know, and I have known for some time."
"You know?"
Nikoros' eyebrows went up so far and fast, Locke was surprised not to see them go sailing off like catapult stones.
"You knew?"
"Of course I did," said Locke soothingly. "It's my job to know things, isn't it? Only thing I couldn't figure out is what the lever was. It's obvious that you're not exactly a willing turncoat."
"Gods! It was my alchemist, my dust alchemist. Receiving it's as bad as selling it. I got caught, and this woman, well, I eventually figured out who she must be. I'm sorry, she offered me a deal, otherwise I'd lose everything. 10 years on a penance barge, then exile."
"Hell of a thing," said Locke. "I'd try to avoid that too if I could."
"I'll resign after tonight," muttered Nikoros. "I'd wager I've done more damage to the Deep Roots than any committee member in our god-damned history."
"Nikoros, you haven't been listening to me," said Locke. "I told you I knew."
"But how does that—"
"You've been my agent more than theirs, delivering exactly what I wanted the Black Aris to hear from a source they considered impeccable."
But I'm certain some of what I had to give them was... It was real, and it was damaging to us."
"Naturally," said Locke. "They wouldn't have listened to you if you hadn't delivered real goods most of the time. I wrote the real stuff off as the price of feeding them the crucial bullshit. So don't resign a damn thing. If the Black Aris lose tonight, it's because you were in a position to serve as my weapon against them. Will that help you sleep a little better at night?"
I hardly know what I should say."
The loosening of the lines of tension on his face was immediate and obvious. "Don't say anything. Just drain that goblet and enjoy the show. This conversation will stay our little secret. Have a good long life, Nikoros. I doubt you'll ever see us again."
"Unless our employers want to bring us back for the next round 5 years hence," muttered Jean as they walked away.
"Maybe if they all want to end up in a fucking coma like the shit bucket with the bird," said Locke.
"And not that I'm against trying to settle the poor fellow down, but how do you think Nikoros will feel about himself if the Black Aris win?"
"Gods damn it, I was just trying to do what I could for the wretched bastard. At least now he can believe I chose to use him as a calculated risk. Come on, let's find this sable chamber and get out of the public eye." 2. 6 staircases and 3 conversations with only partially helpful attendants later, they found Sabatha waiting for them in a balcony room overlooking the south side of the Grand Salon. Some long-dead nobleman stared eerily from a wall fresco, gazing out at a scroll-worked metal screen that allowed a fine view of the crowd and the stage below. Sabatha wore another ensemble more in the fashion of a riding outfit than a ball gown, a tight red velvet jacket with slashed sleeves over a dress of black silk panels embroidered in scarlet astronomical signs. Locke pieced them together in his head and realized she was wearing a sunrise and moonrise chart for this very day, month, and calendar year.
"Like it?" she said, spreading her arms. "In accordance with the instructions of my principals, I did my bit to spend every last copper they gave me."
"Dutiful to authority, that's you every time," said Locke.
She offered her hand, and he wasn't shy in kissing it. The trio made themselves comfortable at a little table provisioned with almond cakes, brandy, and four red crystal snifters. Locke took the lead and seized the bottle. "A glass poured to air for absent friends," he said as he filled the fourth snifter and pushed it aside. "May the lessons they taught us give everyone a hell of a show tonight."
"Here's to living long enough to appreciate whatever happens," said Jean.
"Here's to politics," said Sabatha. "Let's never hop in bed with it again."
They touched glasses and drank. The stuff had a pale caramel color and washed Locke's throat with sweet, welcome heat. Not an alchemical brandy, but one of the old-fashioned Western styles with hints of peach and walnut woven into its vapors.
"Here comes the verdict," said Sabatha.
Down on the floor, the crowd parted for a troop of bluecoats, escorting somberly dressed officials carrying wooden chests and huge brass speaking trumpets like blossoming tulips. These trumpets were secured to projections on the stage, and the wooden chests were set down behind them. A petite woman with thick grey curls cut short at the neck stepped up to one of the speaking trumpets.
"First Magistrate Sedelkis," said Sabatha, "arbiter of the change. Come election season, she's like a temporary 14th god."
"No representative from the Magi?" said Locke. "They don't even send a plate of fruit and a kind note?"
"I understand they vouchsafe this ceremony," said Sabatha, "so gods help anyone who tries to adjust the tab."